If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
You know, I've seen some clips of what you've done.
How much strength did it cause to rip off her windshield wiper?
And some of them you seem very tough.
Because you seem so eager to talk about how little you weigh.
And some you seem very fair.
Sure, no. I like you.
Because you got good sense. You asking all the right questions.
Is it an act? I mean, do you consider yourself an actress?
It's a small claims court. We have three judges instead of just one. The litigants come in. These are all real cases. No actors, no fabricated drama.
Has there ever been a case where the three of you have really had a hard time making a decision?
Oh, yeah. It happens frequently.
It's very clear this event was not up to par. This was ham. This is what I call ham.
Yeah.
A hot-ass mess.
Were you a sitting judge before this? Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni, who do you think is winning in the court of public opinion?
Justin Baldoni, without a doubt.
Sean Combs, Brian Koberger. Can you talk about Scott Peterson? Did you ever follow that?
Yeah, murderers are stupid people. Every time that the defense is kind of like, why would somebody be that dumb? It's like criminals are really dumb.
Right.
I mean, you couldn't even imagine.
Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. In today's episode, we are honored to have host Judge Rachel Juarez, a distinguished attorney and one of the esteemed three judges on the Emmy-nominated court program Hot Bench, created by none other than Judge Judy. A Los Angeles native, she graduated from Yale University and Stanford Law School. Judge Juarez has an extensive background in complex civil litigation and family law. Today, she brings her wealth of experience to our discussion, where we delve into her journey into the legal profession, her path to becoming a judge on Hot Bench, and what it's like to serve on the show's unique three-judge panel. Additionally, we explore the latest legal dramas and scandals, including those involving Blake Lively, Justin Baldoni, P. Diddy, and so many more. Judge Juarez shares insights into a case currently captivating her attention. You do not want to miss this engaging conversation with one of today's most insightful legal minds. Welcome, Rachel Juarez. Judge Rachel Juarez, is that how you pronounce it? Thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. Where are you based?
So I'm in Los Angeles.
Okay. Right now. And are you in Los Angeles because you're a big star or because that's where you wanted to be?
No, I've been in Los Angeles my whole life. I was born and raised here. And in fact, our show is now shooting in Connecticut. So I'm actually commuting out of Los Angeles to shoot Hot Bench.
Oh, wow. Okay. I love this. All right. So let's get into your journey, please. You have an impressive career path. You're now on this, you know, the hottest syndicated courtroom show. How did you get here? Talk to me about your childhood, what you wanted to be, and how you found a love for law.
So I was one of those little kids that people thought there was something wrong with her when she was six, because she would go around saying, I want to be a lawyer. And I don't really think at the time I knew why or what that was. Both my parents were lawyers. I just thought it sounded cool. Mm-hmm. But as I got older, I really liked the performance aspect of law. I started doing mock trial, and I really liked the concept of creating a story and trying to convince a jury or a judge of something and kind of putting it all together in that sense and being a storyteller. And so I really wanted to be a trial lawyer. And I kind of went.
And did you have a certain aspect of law that you really liked, whether it was marriage, you know, family type of stuff or criminal stuff?
So at first, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, but I eventually decided criminal law was too depressing and difficult and emotionally draining. Mm. So I eventually went into international litigation. I represented Samsung, Mattel, Google, you know, companies like that. And then when I had kids, it was a lot to also be a mom and do that. So I went into family law.
Got it. Okay. So what made you, like, in the meantime, were you somebody who was very into television shows? Did you watch a lot of the courtroom drama type of things? I mean, I was always watching court TV or HLN at the time that had a lot of court stuff.
Yeah, I've always loved court TV. I've always loved watching trials that are live. And I've watched some of the court shows as well. I mean, I had seen Hot Bench, obviously, before I was on it. Mm-hmm. But I really loved watching the trials, even the ones that I think are boring to other people that are on for 8 hours a day, because most trials are not exciting. Right. I loved watching them still.
Yeah, I do too. I find them fascinating. All right. So how did you get into being on TV then? How does that translate? Were you a sitting judge before this?
No, I was not. I had been trained by the Los Angeles Superior Court to be a temporary judge. So I had
What does that mean?
Yeah, I had training. They basically, if you go through a whole program with the court, they give you extensive training so that you can sit several days a year when judges are on vacation, when there's an open courtroom, in traffic court, in family law. I was training for traffic court, but I could have also done family law because that's where I practice in. So I was trained to be a temporary judge only, but not a sitting judge.
Right. So like a substitute teacher.
Exactly. Kind of. Yeah.
Okay. And did you love doing that?
So I did. It was interesting. But right as I was kind of getting started on that journey, Hot Bench came from a totally different direction, totally unrelated to that. And it was because I was representing at the time a couple of people in the industry. And one of them ended up reaching out to the producer of Hot Bench and saying, you know, I know you're looking for a new judge, and I think she would be fantastic. My divorce lawyer. So I got a call from a producer. I had just had a baby. I was about, you know, 4 weeks postpartum. And he said, do you want to try out to be a judge on TV? And I thought it was a joke. I was like, I had no idea it was coming. I said, I mean, I don't know. Tell me more about it. And it turned out, yeah, one of my clients had said, you should call my divorce lawyer. She'd be hysterical.
So, and what was the process like of you having to try out for the role?
So we did a bunch of chemistry tests with different combinations because they were replacing two of our three judges.
Okay.
So the one judge that was staying did a bunch of chemistry tests with all different combinations of different judges. And then I didn't hear anything for about a month and thought, you know, that was a fun story to tell. And then I got a call saying, you want to sign a contract and start filming next week.
Oh my God.
It was a lot of different chemistry tests with different judges.
Right. So now you're going into season 12. Does that actually mean 12 years? How do the seasons run?
So it is a season a year. It's 12 years for the show. I started on season 9.
Oh, got it. Okay.
So this will be my fourth year on the show. Right now we're airing season 11 and we're about to start filming season 12.
Got it. And what I'm curious, like the difference in reality, you know, the reality of courtrooms, which of course, I mean, I think it's obvious to anyone, these kind of courtroom things are the timing is much smaller. I mean, you only have half an hour or whatever it is, an hour to tell a story. Whereas in real life, these courtroom things are more drawn out. Am I correct?
Absolutely. For big trials that we would see on like court TV, they would be much more drawn out. But for the types of cases we get, which are small claims cases, they actually wouldn't necessarily be more drawn out in real life. When you go to a small claims court, they hear 8 or 9 cases a day, just like we do. Sometimes if they're complicated, they take more time with them, but it's very common for the kind of cases we get in small claims to be heard in 20 or 30 minutes in a real courtroom too.
Right. What is your personal philosophy on justice? I mean, we before the show started, we were talking about different judges out there, and some really are compassionate to the stories they hear, and they choose to believe them or not based on their life experience. And some people are just like, this is the letter of the law, and this is what I have to do. What's your personal philosophy?
It's a great question. It's evolving, actually. I think when I started on the show, I really felt strongly, it's the letter of the law. I don't care how weird this may sound, how compassionate this argument is. The law is the law, no matter what result it produces.
Yeah.
I still believe the law is the law, and I like to rule based on law and facts rather than emotion. But the concept of equity, of overall fairness, has become more important as I've spent more time on the show and kind of realized that the law is not perfect.
Right.
And you know, there's a lot of other things that are important to delivering justice other than the letter of the law.
Right. So now for people that haven't seen the show, can you explain it a little bit?
Yeah. So basically it's a small claims court. We have 3 judges instead of just one. Mm-hmm. And that is the big difference between our courtroom and any other trial courtroom in the country. And the litigants come in. These are all real cases, no actors, no fabricated drama. These are all people. Yeah, go ahead.
And sorry, my question there is, have they submitted these cases to you guys or a court submitted them to you? How does that work?
So every single case is filed in a real courthouse somewhere across the country. Typically, how we get our cases is we have people who go to the courthouse, pull new filings, and write letters to people and say, we heard you filed a case. Would you like to be on our show?
I see.
Occasionally, someone will reach out to us and say, I have a case. I'd like you to hear it.
Got it. So they had to do the real filings. Do they come with, are a lot of people representing themselves or do they have lawyers with them?
No lawyers allowed. So no lawyers allowed in our courtroom and no lawyers allowed, I think, in most small claims courtrooms.
Oh, got it. Okay. So you're always just telling your own story. I don't know. Yep. I've never sued anybody in small claims court, although I feel like I threaten to do it all the time.
Much better. You don't want to go to small claims court. That's the right place to be.
So what are the rules of small claims? Does it mean it has to be like under $5,000?
So depending on which court, which state it's in, there's a limit. It's usually $5,000, $10,000, sometimes $20,000. Our courtroom maximum is $5,000.
So
we get in our court a lot of people who sued for maybe $8,000, but they decide to come to us understanding they can only collect $5,000.
Got it. And do they get something out of being on television?
The pleasure of being on television.
Got it. They're 15 minutes of fame.
Right. And I think that's why a lot of people do it.
Right.
A small appearance fee, a trip to Los Angeles or Connecticut now.
Right.
And I also think a lot of people who have, especially those that have been to court before, they really like that we have 3 judges. They have 3 people hearing their case. And so they get kind of the pleasure of really being heard out.
Right.
I mean, not everybody who comes would tell you that, but I think some would.
Right. Has there ever been a case where the 3 of you, meaning the judges, have really had a hard time making a decision?
Oh, yeah. It happens frequently.
Okay.
And majority rules. So it's 2-1. And if we can't decide, whoever the majority, the 2 are, that's the winning argument. That's the decision of the court. And then whoever disagrees is the dissenting judge. And we just make a record saying, I would have ruled differently, but whatever the majority says goes.
Right. And do you guys have any say in picking the cases? How do you prepare before the show? Do you actually know what the case is about? Have you really read the briefs or whatever you're getting?
Yeah. So we don't have any say in picking the cases. Occasionally, we'll read a case and say we don't want to hear it for one reason or another. But the producers are the ones that choose which cases to hear.
Right.
And then we get, before we start filming, a complaint from the plaintiff, an answer from the defendant, which is just basically their story in one page. Very simple. And then we get some evidence ahead of time.
Some
people are really good. They give us all sorts of stuff, more than we could ever go through. And some people who, you know, their entire case is about one piece of paper, don't even bring that one piece of paper. So right. It really varies.
Right. So funny. And I've always wondered about these judges, about how they come up with their persona. So we talked a little bit about this already, but, you know, I've seen some clips of what you've done, and some of them you seem very tough and some you seem very fair. But, you know, is it an act? I mean, do you consider yourself an actress?
Not at all. I don't consider myself an actress at all. And we are totally an unscripted show. Oh. So we have no writers. We continued filming during the writer's strike because we have no writers on staff. And everything you see us say, we are saying in real time. Nobody is writing us notes. We don't have teleprompters. Nobody gives us a script. So, you know, everything is really organic and comes really from us. It is very much reality TV as opposed to acting. Right. I don't feel like I'm acting at all.
So has doing the show become your primary job, or are you an acting lawyer at the same time and representing real clients?
I still have a full-time practice. I'm in my real office right now. I do that more of the time right now, but I am really loving not only Hot Bench, but a lot of the legal commentary stuff. So right. I'm kind of trying to move more in that direction now that it's been a couple of years and I've really gotten a chance to see that I love it.
Right. Exactly. All right. So let's get into the legal commentary stuff and let's go through some of the cases that are popular right now. The first thing I want to ask you before we get into it, what is your personal belief on the difference in law and facts versus, you know, and proving your case based on facts versus public opinion and that winning a case? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, obviously, depending on the case, what is happening in the court of public opinion can be much more important than what's happening in real court. Mm. Right now, that doesn't happen for the majority of cases. But like for Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni, I really believe what's happening in the court of public opinion is going to be more important for the two of them than the outcome of the legal case.
Oh, so, I see what you're saying. It'll affect them and their career more so than whatever monetary issue goes on at the end of the case.
Exactly. And I think it was the same for Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. I mean, obviously, that was a lot of money she had to pay. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the trajectory of their life and career, the outcome of what people thought was much more important than what happened in the trial, I think.
But do you think it ever affects what happens in the trial and the jurors? Or do you think that people can really be that partial in there?
So I think the number of cases where the jury really has an idea of what's going on publicly is very small.
Right.
I think they do a very good job. It's not perfect in very high profile cases, but I think they do a really good job of sussing out which jurors have prior information. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, there's going to be a little bit of bias, if you will, that jurors bring into the process.
Right.
But I think they always do that. It's not just because they've heard something in the case. It could be because they have a sheriff as a brother. So they like sheriffs and the witness is a sheriff, or a doctor did something bad to them in the past. So they don't like doctors. You know, everybody's got life that they bring into it.
Right. Okay. So in following the Blake Lively and Justin Baldoni legal dispute at this point, who do you think is winning in the court of public opinion?
Justin Baldoni, without a doubt.
Why do you think that is?
I think he's crushing it in the court of public opinion. And I think, you know, it's very hard these days, I think as it should be, to come back from sexual harassment allegations, from, you know, those sort of, you know, abuse and domestic violence type things. And so when that gets out there, I think it's very hard for someone to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. And somehow he's managed, I think, to turn the tide, and not by just being the meaner person or by smearing her as a person, but by coming and showing that her allegations are not true or don't appear to be true, because I don't think we really know yet.
Well, but what are the legal implications of publicizing legal evidence online? So he created a whole website and put all the evidence on here. Doesn't he have to save that for trial? And I saw somewhere that the judge actually ruled that this could be a problem and they have to have like a gag order about doing this anymore.
So Blake Lively asked for a gag order. And this is kind of a perfect example of how lawyers really spin what happens in court, right?
Okay.
Lawyers came out and said, we won. He ruled that they can't do this. That's not what happened. What the judge did was deny the request for a gag order. which was a big loss for Blake Lively. But he added, as judges often do, you know, we all have to remember that there are rules about what you can and cannot put out there when there's an ongoing case. So the issue with what Justin Baldoni did, very smart. It was a smart move by his attorneys. They only actually technically put up on that website court documents.
Okay.
And but what they had done, you know, they publicized other things that were not court documents. But there's nothing wrong with publicizing court documents. They're public documents. You can get them on the court's website.
Okay.
But what they did was they put a bunch of stuff that normally wouldn't be in court documents so that they could say that. And, you know, I think, in my opinion,
was it their response that they then put up there? Okay. So they made sure in writing the response, they knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Got it.
Oh yeah. They made it, you know, hundreds of pages. They attached a 170 page timeline to his response, which you're never going to see in any normal case.
Right.
But I think one of the big things that matters here, and one of the reasons the judge said no gag order, is because she started it. I mean, she was the one that initiated this public campaign with the New York Times. Right. You know, whether or not that was okay for her to do, I'm not weighing in on. I'm not saying she shouldn't have, but she started the media blitz. And he had to defend himself. And all of the rules surrounding what lawyers can and cannot do publicly rely very heavily on whether you're starting it or you're defending yourself.
Really?
Yes. So the professional rules of conduct, specifically in this case, that they have to follow, depend to a great extent on whether or not the public statements you're making are necessary to defend yourself against accusations that have become public.
I see. Okay. Holistic Goddess has been such a trusted resource for me on my health journey. One product I really wanted to highlight is their Holistic Menopause Support by PhD Health. It's been a game changer for me during perimenopause, and here's why I love it. It eases discomfort. It really helps with hot flashes and mood swings. It boosts focus. The ingredients in it, including creatine, support mental sharpness. I feel more focused and clear-headed, which is so important for my busy days. It nurtures comfort. It gently addresses vaginal dryness with black cohosh. It's comforting to have that support during this time. It has natural ingredients. I love that it uses these ingredients like sage and rhubarb extract. If you're going through similar changes like perimenopause and menopause, I highly recommend giving this a try. It's been a relief for me, and I think it could help you too. Go to holisticgoddess.com and use code UNDERSTOOD for 15% off all orders. Again, that's holisticgoddess.com for 15% off using code UNDERSTOOD. Code UNDERSTOOD for 15% off all orders. Again, that's holisticgoddess.com for 15% off using code UNDERSTOOD.
So, and what are your thoughts on this New York Times thing? So I've done work with the New York Times. I had a huge article that I wrote with them. I had to supply them with years of evidence when they did this. And the only reason I'm bringing this up is because it literally took them 8 months to read, and they had all these, you know, legal advisors and all this stuff happen for it even to be able to come out. Okay. So when it came out, I said, well, they had to fact check that because I've worked with them and I know how stringent they are about that. But then when you see what Justin put out, you're like, well, wait a minute, they didn't fact check that, or they did, but they took it out of context. What's your thought on that?
Yeah. I mean, it clearly looks like they fell short in some way. And, you know, we know that an article like this does take months to come out. They must have been working on it for months. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of shocking to see some of the things that he put out showing that they published three text messages and then omitted the fourth, which shows that they were talking about something totally different.
Right.
So, you know, I think that this could have been something where they were heavily influenced by the publicists, people they have long-standing relationships with.
Right.
Craft an article in a particular way.
Right. I mean, and that was really detrimental. That's what sent this off in a whole new direction,
yeah.
I feel like. Okay. So where do you think this is going? I mean, first of all, before I ask you that, why do you think she even bothered to do this? Do you think it really stemmed from the fact that her reputation, she felt like it was so bad at that moment?
That's the $1 million question. Why would she do this? You know, and that's, I think, one of the biggest arguments in favor of believing her.
Right.
There's no good reason for her to do this other than she's trying to stand up for herself and the other women on set that she claims this happened to as well.
Mm-hmm.
If that's not the case, the theories I have heard put out there are obviously what you just said, the reputational issue. She just couldn't stand some bad press, but also that this is part of some campaign to get control over the next movie that's coming out. And I just don't think we really know enough about that and how this might interact with that to know whether that's a viable argument or not.
Right, right. Well, did you see the movie?
I did. After all of this came out, then I saw the movie.
Did you like it?
It was fine. I feel like after it was hyped so much, not necessarily as a good movie, it was a little bit of a letdown, but it was a fine movie. I enjoyed it.
Right. Well, what I found was interesting before all these lawsuits came out was that, you remember, she did all the press that had nothing to do with domestic violence. He did all the press that had to do with the domestic violence aspect of it. And then she had that really cringeworthy interview where the woman says, congratulations on your baby bump. And she's like, congratulations on yours. That has nothing to do with sexual harassment. Okay. That has to do with just being an asshole. So like, that was a terrible look for her. And then I see the lawsuit and I still was like, well, what does that have to do with sexual harassment? So, you know, I felt like she contributed to her own bad press. I didn't think of him having anything to do with it.
I totally agree with you. And I think that the evidence that we're seeing come out has supported the argument that this was not some, you know, under the radar smear campaign that was really just, you know, finding every little thing about her, but that it was an organic response.
Right.
That interview with any woman who's been pregnant, you know, can sympathize, I think, with that reporter, how awful that is.
Yeah.
Dating you. It's bullying. I mean, it really is. It's the worst kind of bullying. And it was horrible.
Yeah. Horrible. All right. So where do you see this going? The trial, I think, has been moved up, moved back. I don't even know where it is right now. But where do you think this is going to go?
I mean, 90% of cases settle, right? So the odds are that this case will settle. I also have to imagine that both sides want to settle this case. They want to get out of the press. They want to stop spending millions of dollars. But this also kind of feels like a really dangerous game of chicken to me. And I think there, if the egos were enough to get to where we are, who's going to set aside their ego and settle?
Right.
And so, you know, I still don't think this case will go to trial because I think it can't in so many ways. But on the other hand, you know, every day that goes by, it's more likely to get to trial because once, you know, the damage is being done slowly and slowly and slowly.
And it's not even that slowly anymore, yeah. but
no, you're right.
I do agree, but that it's not going to get to trial. However, I think the only way for a settlement to happen is for them to say, okay, we're going to just stop this. No one's going to ask the other one for money, but someone's going to have to admit that they were wrong. So I can see Justin saying, okay, I'll walk away and I'll settle this, but you have to admit you brought this with ill intent or that there was no facts to back it up because you need to clear my name. That's the only way I could see him settling. I feel like he wants this to go to the end to prove himself.
Yeah, I've talked a lot about this. I actually think it is possible Justin Baldoni would settle without an apology because the fact of the lawsuit going away when the public tide is already 95% in his opinion, at least that's what it feels like, might be enough for him to be the hero.
Right.
I think if you just pulled the plug right now, he's won by a lot.
Agreed.
So I could maybe see him agreeing to a settlement without an apology, but I don't know how she does that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, without any vindication for her claim, she just drops them. Doesn't feel like that's going to happen.
Right. Exactly. All right. Well, that'll be very interesting to see where this goes. I'm here for it for sure.
Me too.
All right. Sean Combs, the upcoming trial. That's happening in a few months. Every time you turn around, there's some other cringeworthy story. What are your thoughts as a lawyer on how this is going to go down? I mean, we already know what the public opinion is, but what are the facts that we're not really paying attention to?
I think the question is how big the scope is going to get, because we're constantly seeing new allegations come out and the prosecutors can still supplement these arguments that they're making. And there's going to be a lot of, I think, fascinating legal issues in terms of how they try this case, because you really have to weigh, you know, putting in all the bad evidence, but also not really getting away from the criminal allegations,
right?
Kind of the way that, you know, Harvey Weinstein's trials have happened and then been reversed and happened and been reversed. There's so much bad stuff out there that it's going to be really fascinating to see how the case is tried. I see it going to trial. I don't think there is any way this case does not go to trial because I don't think the prosecutors will settle for anything other than the rest of his life in jail.
Right.
I don't think he, why would he take that when he
What could his defense be beyond he didn't do it and they're all lying?
I think that has to be the defense.
Right.
I mean, they all consented. I mean, there's some kind of hint of, you know, a lot of these parties, they weren't drugged against their will. They were not, you know, they gave their consent to everything that was happening. I mean,
oh, that's a good point, that he wouldn't deny it at this point in trial, maybe, but he would say it happened. It was consensual. And if they could, I guess, show some evidence or some witnesses to back that up, maybe they have a little bit of a case.
Maybe. I mean, I doubt it would be a very good defense.
Right.
But yeah, I think it'll be a combination of some things didn't happen. Right. We know for the one instance with Jay-Z that's come out, that's been alleged, there seems to be evidence that people have referred to that the alleged victim wasn't even in the location on the day she claimed. So there may be some allegations where they say this just didn't happen. But the rest, I would assume they were saying they came to a party to have fun. And the fact that it was a large orgy, frankly, you know, it doesn't mean that they were doing anything against their will.
Right. True. Do you see any challenges that you could predict coming for the prosecution?
Yeah, I think it's going to be this issue of character evidence, right? What, you know, they have to provide context to what's going on. And they've brought a RICO case, which is basically they're charging him as if he's the mob. You know, RICO was a statute created to be able to capture all the activities that a criminal organization engages in. And they've alleged it that way. But at the same time, there's going to be an issue of some of the stuff they want to bring out about him really isn't relevant to the criminal allegations. And it's just going to prejudice the jury. So I think there's going to have to be a very fine line between, you know, let's stick to the facts, but also in order to understand the context, you need to understand about the freak-offs. You need to understand about how the women were treated afterwards.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, they can't make their case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, Brian Koberger, the trial in Idaho. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm so excited for that one. I think this is going to be like the true crime trial of the century.
Now, do you think he did it?
Of course, I think he did it. Right now, you know, I mean, I'm staying unbiased, right? Because we know in that case particularly, there's a lot of evidence we haven't seen. And there's a lot going on behind closed doors that we don't necessarily know about.
Right.
But gosh, I mean, you know, right? You turn off your phone at that time of night, your DNA is at the scene. Seems kind of unlikely that that's just all a big coincidence.
Right. But remember watching, you know, I couldn't stop watching the Casey Anthony trial. And we were like, she did it. There's all this evidence. I mean, I guess there wasn't evidence, but there was all this crazy circumstantial evidence that pointed to the fact that she lost this kid and something must have happened to her because of all the lies. And then when you get to the trial and you see Jose Baez come out with that crazy defense and she got off, it was insane.
Yeah. I mean, I still think she did it. I don't know if I can say that, right? But
of course. I think everyone thinks she did it.
Changed my mind. I think it didn't change most people's minds.
Well, yeah. I mean, and on a side note, talking about that, I still never understood if she was going to suggest that the kid, I think she said the kid drowned in the pool and the dad helped her bury the body and the dad was sexually assaulting everybody, abusing everybody. How come no one took the dad to trial? So I thought that was bullshit. And I couldn't believe that no one besides Nancy Grace was up in arms about the whole thing.
Yeah. No, I think it's outrageous what happened. If I had been doing this back then, I would have been, you know, right next to Nancy. And it was nuts. And I think I really don't see the Koberger case going this way, but you never know. You really never know.
Right. So I saw recently there was something in the news where his lawyers had asked to throw something out. I believe it had to do with DNA. Is that correct? Do you know the facts of that?
Yep. They've asked to throw everything out. So they've said that the DNA was improperly obtained because the FBI essentially went through one of these public DNA databases and identified the DNA relation, I think, to his father. Okay. And they say that shouldn't have been done, because the FBI violated the terms of service of the website that had that information on it, which is kind of like a big so what, right?
Right.
So maybe the website can sue the FBI if they didn't give them permission, but that's not a Fourth Amendment issue.
Right.
And then they've asked to throw out basically all the other evidence too, for various reasons. I watched those hearings. It didn't look very compelling to me, the arguments, but the judge in that case is spectacular. And He's hard to read. And he asked both sides some really challenging questions. So I don't think any of that stuff will get kicked, but, you know, we'll see.
Do you think Brian has a good trial attorney?
I'm gonna withhold judgment on that.
Okay.
I think the arguments made thus far are not particularly compelling by his lawyers.
Got it.
But that's also probably in part because they don't have good arguments to make.
Right. Like that was my next question. Yeah.
Yeah. Every defense lawyer has to try to get the DNA thrown out. You have right. to. So, but I don't think that the lawyers we're going to see in this particular case are going to be as theatrical or as compelling as some of the lawyers we've seen, like Jose Baez, like, you know, in, I'm trying to think of other good examples, in Johnny Depp and Amber Heard case. I think they're more kind of local attorneys that don't have as much of the theatrics behind them.
Right, right. Did you watch the Karen Reed trial at all?
I watched some of it, yeah. I watched some excerpts from that trial. Whew, that one was...
That was a doozy. Yes. Did you have an opinion on that one when it was happening?
No. I mean, yeah, I had lots of opinions, but I think in a lot of these other cases, I have a very strong opinion about what I think happened there. I don't in that
right,
case.
Right.
I felt myself kind of, you know, hearing one witness and saying, oh gosh, clearly she did this.
Right.
And then hearing some other evidence and saying, well, that seems very odd.
Right.
Why would that be the case?
Right. So, it's interesting you say that because there were so many circumstances where her attitude, the bizarre behavior, whatever it was, she clearly did it. But then when you look at the facts and these weird, bizarre behaviors of the people in the house that night and the fact that more damage would have been done with the car. And I mean, it's just like almost common sense stuff didn't match up. And so it was very hard. But, you know, here we are and she's off again. Do you know the detail? Does she have to go back to trial? I can't remember now.
I think they're going to retry her. You know, it'll be interesting to see because there are so many problems with that case. I think it's a case that if it had not gotten headlines, they would call it a day after what happened at this point.
Yeah.
But I think they kind of have to retry her. And I completely agree with you. This was one where every day I kind of changed my mind because there was such good evidence for both sides in a way that it seemed like she totally did it and like she totally didn't do it at the same time.
It's interesting to watch a lot of these trials because you end up hearing all this gossip, like that Johnny Depp may have been sleeping with his lawyer, or to me, it looked like Karen Reed had a very cozy relationship with her lawyer. And I can imagine, and same thing with like Casey Anthony and Jose, you heard rumors about that. You really bond with these people because they're saving your life and they're the closest thing you have to a god, right? So I can see how that little romance would happen. Can you?
Absolutely. It's against most ethical guidelines in most states to do that, to become involved with a client who you are representing. But I can also see, you know, when you're that closely involved with someone and it's their life, you know, it's similar for me when I do divorces, right? This is their whole life.
Right.
You know, how a friendship develops, how this is the only person that knows some of your deepest, darkest secrets. So even if it doesn't, you know, blossom into a romance, it blossoms into a very close and complicated relationship. And so it might, the appearance to others, you know, the hand on the waist or the arm around the shoulder or the whispering, you know, this is someone your life is in their hands. And so you're going to be closer to them than you would really even your best friend at the time.
Yeah, you're right. That's a good opinion there. All right, let's talk about the Menendez brothers' potential resentencing. What do you think about them? Do you think that they've been in jail long enough?
That's such a hard one. I don't know. I think they had to go to jail for a very long time. I think you don't get to kill your mom, especially, you know, you don't get to go up and reload and come back. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, no matter how bad things are, on the other hand, things were sound like they were really bad.
So does anyone not believe the sexual assault thing with the dad? I don't know where we are with that because then, you know, all these new documentaries come out and I just don't get it anymore. I've lost track of what we think the facts are.
Yeah. So I think pretty much people are tending to believe that happened now.
Okay.
When they were convicted, the main difference between the first trial and the second trial, where they were eventually convicted, was that the judge did not allow a lot of that stuff in. And so that didn't play as big a role, I think, as people feel like it should have in the second trial where they were
convicted. Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. Yeah.
So that was one of the big things that changed. The judge streamlined things much more and said, we're not going to get into all this extraneous stuff.
But wouldn't that have created created motive?
Yes. So I think that there were some limited ability to make allegations, but some of the evidence, the collateral evidence, like the letters,
right,
were not allowed in.
Got it. So at that point, it was almost like the jury had to either believe it was true or not.
Yeah.
And it, without the evidence, obviously the jury didn't find it to be credible.
Right. And they weren't testifying, you know, to all of this stuff. And so, you know, I think probably what tips it for me is that they have been model citizens in prison. You know, these are guys that are never going to commit another crime in their lives. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be repeat offenders. The family of the victims, which happened to be their family as well, believes they should be out of jail. Mm-hmm. If the family of the people you killed thinks it's time for you to leave jail, that's pretty compelling to me after this amount of time.
Right.
So I would tend to err on the side of, you know, it's time, that it's okay to let them go, but I would not be offended if they remained in jail. I would not think that was horrible.
So what would the process be for a potential resentencing? Does that mean they have to go to trial again and give all the evidence, or are these just briefs that their lawyers bring in?
Just briefs. It'll be the judge that ultimately resentences them. I think what's happening now is Los Angeles switched district attorneys with this past election. So Los Angeles had Gascon, who was on the very liberal side, I think, of punishment issues, who was the acting district attorney, who was the district attorney here for many years. And the public voted him out overwhelmingly. The public was not happy with him and voted in a much more conservative attorney, a really good attorney, but much more conservative to take over the role. And so Gascon had said, I think it's time for them to come out of jail. He had kind of reviewed everything. He knew what he felt and what the prosecutor thinks is a big component of resentencing. Mm-hmm. Now, the new district attorney has said, we need more time. I need more time to review everything and make my own decision. And he kind of ran on a, I'm going to be tougher on crime than this liberal guy, you know, platform. And that appealed to voters. I mean, he was voted in overwhelmingly. So I don't know if that means he will make a different conclusion, but I think he probably feels some pressure to say, I'm the tough on crime guy. I'm not going to just let murderers out of jail.
Right. That's a really good
point.
We'll
see.
Okay. Well, we will see. What's the latest? I didn't ask you this before, but can you talk about Scott Peterson? Did you ever follow that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean,
That was so interesting.
That to me is even more so than Casey Anthony, even more than all these other cases, the most obvious example of course he did it. Right.
But is it? They did a whole documentary where they kind of made you think, did he do it?
It didn't make me think that. I mean, I know that was the point. I know a lot of people came away thinking that, but
right.
I just think this guy would have to be the unluckiest man in the history of unlucky men.
Right.
To say to his mistress, you know, my wife is, there's a different type of gone, you know, and then it turns out somebody else abducted and murdered his wife. I mean,
it's right. Like,
how could that? I just think the coincidences are too huge.
Right.
I don't know how it's possible he didn't do it.
Yeah. I mean, that every bit of that story is like a made for TV movie. I mean, it's so ridiculous and fake and the players in it. And I mean, it just was insane. And then remember all of a sudden when you see Amber Fry come out with Gloria Allred and we're like, what?
Yeah.
Amazing. This is like just the popcorn. You got to get it and start watching. It was fantastic. Yeah.
It's like reality is better than fiction, right? I mean,
yeah.
It's the same thing on our show. Like our craziest cases, you couldn't write them.
Right.
You know, because nobody would think of something that incredibly entertaining and amazing, you know?
Right.
It's the same. I think if you scripted that case, people would say, oh, that's so far-fetched. That could never happen.
Right. Are there any other cases that you're watching that we might not know of because they're not, you know, as big and out there that we should follow?
So I think, to me, the best kind of true crime case out there in the last few years has been Lori Vallow Daybell.
I'm obsessed with that one.
Me too. Obsessed. I watched every day of the live tweeting of what was happening in the courtroom.
Yeah.
They didn't televise that one. So I watched up to date what was happening every day, listen to the audio afterwards.
I listened to all of that. And by the way, can we just talk about this for a second? I wasn't going to bring this up because I didn't even think she's in jail. So I've figured, oh, it's over. But the fact that it had so many different parts to it, that her ex-husband was murdered, her brother, was it the brother that died on the toilet from something? I mean, then the guy she's now married to, his wife died 2 weeks before. And I felt like the local media at the beginning wasn't putting this together. And I'm like listening to the 911 calls. And I'm like, this woman is so guilty. What is going on? Where are these kids? And I remember when we were following the story, when the kids were still missing. And it was just so terrible because you knew the kids were not alive. I mean,
yeah.
And then the fact that they found them was incredible. But the fact that they found him on her boyfriend's property or her husband's property, I mean, they just couldn't have been arrested quick enough. And the fact that the police kept going to Hawaii and being like, where are the kids? I was like, throw them in jail. This is crazy.
I still remember the video of Nate Eaton, the guy from the, you know, reporter, the Idaho newspaper, who's now famous because of this case,
right,
of him like walking after them in Hawaii saying like, where are your children? Where are your children? And they're just like walking, holding hands, yeah, like kind of
like
sway.
They're on vacation.
It's, I mean, that case, when I was watching, I think the Dateline, you know, episodes about that case, my husband came in and after like 10 minutes said, what movie is that? Like, how have I not seen this? I said, this is not a movie. This is a documentary about, you know, something that really happened. So
right. She's
going to go to trial in Arizona now. For the death of her third husband.
Right. Okay. The one that was shot?
Yes.
Okay.
By
the brother.
Brother, right.
Yeah.
Who's now dead, who dropped dead out of nowhere.
On the toilet.
Was it on the toilet?
Oh, on my toilet.
Yeah. Right. And then Chad Daybell is going to trial. Her husband is going to trial.
Oh, I didn't realize they were all going to trial. Okay. This is exciting.
And it's going to be televised. That's the big woo. They're going to
televise where on court TV?
I have no idea. I think they said it's only going to be live streamed from directly from the courthouse website. But then if they do that, anybody can put courthouse, you know, court TV can carry it. Anybody can carry it. It'll go on YouTube, you know. And so all of these, it's going to be the same case that Lori's case was. It's going to be all the same witnesses, all the same evidence. So all this stuff that we got to hear about and kind of read about, we're going to get to see. And I'm taking a month off, 2 months, 3 months off work, and I'm going to be watching every day.
Oh, I love it.
It's going to be fascinating.
Me too. I mean, this is going to be so exciting. All right. Any other cases that are less known that you think are fantastic that we should be watching?
No, I think, you know, you had a couple interesting ones come cropping up, you know, because everybody's so fascinated with true crime. But I think they're all kind of coming and dying, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
I was fascinated by the woman who went missing in Los Angeles, but then they found her.
One who faked her own disappearance?
Or who now says she didn't fake it, who just said she just went to Mexico, right? And her father came out to look for her and then committed suicide.
Oh, that one.
Yes.
Whatever happened with that?
They found her.
They found her, but what was her excuse? She was trying to run away?
Yeah, she just like went to Mexico because she just wanted to. I don't think she ever really publicly spoke out about what. Hannah Gutierrez, is that
right?
She basically said enough to make clear she was safe and she had not been abducted or trafficked or intimidated into going anywhere. And then it sort of started to come out that she and the ex-boyfriend had been involved in some kind of green card marriage thing that was going on, but it kind of just died once they found her. I mean, I thought that was going to be the new Daybell case, right? The dad commits suicide and there's a green card marriage scam and she's gone. And the guy who was following her around is gone. But no, it's just kind of.
Yeah. It wasn't all that exciting. You know, which one I still am into. They made a couple documentaries about it. The Making of a Murderer, Stephen Avery.
Oh yes.
I mean, do you think he's guilty of that second murder?
Yeah. I mean,
you do?
Do I think he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt? No.
Okay.
Right. Do I think, and that to me is one of the interesting things with a lot of these true crime cases. You know, I talked a lot about one, which is actually very interesting, about 20 years. It was 40 years ago. It was a guy who killed his wife with an axe. They didn't solve it. And then about 35 years later, they came back and prosecuted him.
Huh.
And that was a case, to me, like Stephen Avery, where I don't think that person should be convicted. I don't think they are guilty legally. But in terms of 51%, did they do it? That's kind of a different analysis to me. I don't think it's beyond a reasonable doubt. But I kind of think it's more likely than not, which is not a basis for a criminal conviction.
See, I don't agree. I thought that, you know, remember the state he lived in was had to pay him like $18 million or something for the first time they put him in jail for so many times, which he was found not guilty for. He comes out. What kind of a moron would come out of jail and then kill a woman? I just don't get it.
I agree with you. But murderers are stupid people, you know? And so every time that the defense is kind of like, why would somebody be that dumb? It's like criminals are really dumb.
Right.
I mean, you couldn't even imagine, right?
Right. Well, except for Ted Bundy. He was pretty smart.
Totally. Oh, yeah. Most of them are dumb. No, you're totally right. They're smart ones. The other one I think that is going to be really interesting to hear more about, even though the case is over, is Robert Durst, right? How it turned out that, like, he kind of, you know, incriminated himself during doing that first documentary. And then
great moment that was.
Oh, fantastic. So that case isn't really followable anymore, but anybody who hasn't watched the Robert Durst documentaries, I can't remember what the name of it now, but
I'll think about it and put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
He's dead now, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's so there's nothing more to follow, but I think in terms of true crime junkies try to find their next fix, I feel like that one didn't get all the press it should have. Oh, right? Yeah. I didn't even know when the first season aired. It wasn't until somebody asked me to come and talk about the case. And I said, God, I don't. Then I went back and I was like, oh my gosh, this is a gold mine.
Right. You know? Right. Right. Well, I love all these takes from you. I find it fascinating. Tell people where they can watch your show. Oh, actually, but hold on. Before I get to that and have you tell people where they can find you, your boss is Judge Judy. So my question is, how much interaction does she have with you and the other judges? And does she come and watch production? Does she tell you what to do? What's your interaction with her?
So she's not a day-to-day producer, right? Okay. She kind of oversees everything, but we don't have a lot of interaction with her. She's the boss, right? She's ultimately in charge behind the scenes, but she's not on set producing day-to-day. She's not calling us about cases or episodes. She's kind of the producer, you know, not only in name because she does weigh in on things with the show, but she's kind of up here and we're kind of down in the trenches. So
has she ever called you guys and said you made the complete wrong decision?
Never, never. But also never said we made the right decision either.
Right.
But she's the goat of, you know, TV judges. She always will be. And so her involvement, we love it whenever she has involvement because there's no one better.
Right. I can imagine. All right. So now tell people where they can watch your show.
Go to Hot Bench's website and you can figure out where we're on every day. In Los Angeles right now, we're on KCAL. In New York, we're on KCBS Channel 2 at 4 o'clock.
Amazing. Good luck to you. I really appreciate your time. It's been great getting to hear all your takes. It'll be fun to see what happens in these trials coming up.
Yes. Can't wait.
Yes.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.